I am particularly pleased this morning to welcome to our congregation the Reverend Sean Raven, who's to my right, who will be our guest minister this morning. Stephen had the pleasure of speaking to Sean's congregation at the Victoria Unitarian Church last year, and in return, we are lucky enough to have Sean here with us this morning. Reverend Lingood is a lifelong Unitarian Universalist who grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. She served a small congregation as a solo minister in Madison, Wisconsin, a large congregation as associate minister in Washington, D.C., and now a mid-sized congregation as co-minister with her wife in Victoria. When not enmeshed in all things ministerial, she's a sports fan, a jazz enthusiast, and a deep appreciator of art and art history. She's also kept quite busy co-parenting her six-year-old daughter and her six-month-old son. Thank you for being here this morning. I'd like to read to you, as our reading this morning, an excerpt from a beautifully written spiritual memoir by Scott Russell Sanders, entitled A Private History of All. On a spring day in 1950, when I was big enough to run about on my own two legs, yet still small enough to ride in my father's arms, he carried me onto the porch of a farmhouse in Tennessee and held me against his chest, humming, while thunder roared and lightning flared and rain sizzled around us. On a spring day, just over 20 years later, I carried my own child onto the porch of a house in Indiana to meet a thunderstorm. And then, after 30 more years, I did the same with my first grandchild. The search for communion with this power has run like a bright thread through all my days. In the world's religions, the animating power may be called God, Logos, Allah, Brahma, Chi, Tao, Creator, Holy Ghost, Great Spirit, Universal Mind, Manitou, Wakantanka, or a host of other names. But in physics, it may simply be called energy. For every such name, I believe, is only a finger pointing toward the prime reality, which eludes all descriptions. Without boundaries or name, this ground of being shapes and sustains everything that exists, surges in every heartbeat, fills every breath, yet it's revealed only in flashes, like a darkened landscape lit by lightning, or in a gradual unveiling, like the contours of a forest laid bare in autumn as the leaves fall. Saints and bodhisattvas may achieve what Christians call mystical union, or Buddhists call satori, a perpetual awareness of the force at the heart of things. For these enlightened few, the world is always lit. For the rest of us, such clarity comes only fitfully, in sudden glimpses or slow revelations. Quakers refer to these insights as openings. As sudden as lightning or as slow as pregnancy, these passages of clear vision occur only now and then, yet they give meaning to every hour. There's nothing exotic about such awakenings. They come to me in midst of family and friends, at work or play, on the street, in the woods, with lighted rooms, or under moon and stars. I am convinced they come to each of us, whatever our age, whatever our circumstances, whatever our beliefs are about ultimate things. The enlightenment I wish to describe is ordinary, earthy, within reach of anyone who pays attention.
Good morning. It's really a pleasure to be with you. I hate to follow the words of Scott Russell Sanders because they're so beautiful. And I hate to do it by introducing myself a little bit more, but I feel I can't just launch into the sermon without sort of saying good morning and hello to all of you, and to say what a pleasure it is to finally meet you after having heard so much about you from Stephen over the 2.5 years that my partner and I have lived and served in Victoria. We come over monthly to meet with a cluster of colleagues here, and we usually meet with Stephen and have come to really value him both as a colleague and as a friend. So it's really a pleasure to be with you this morning, and it's a pleasure to see a couple of colleagues in the audience here or in the congregation here this morning, because we often say when we gather that we're usually busy on Sunday morning, so we don't ever actually get to see one another lead worship. So it's kind of a, what is it like to watch you lead worship? I've never seen that before. What kind of things do you do? So it's good to be with you, and I apologize ahead of time for my cold. You can probably hear a little bit of nasalness in my voice that isn't normally there, but I hopefully won't cough my way through this morning's sermon. So I love those words of Scott Russell Sanders that Leslie just shared with you. I read that book, really ate my way through it, because I believe, as he does, in those openings in our lives, in the richness that can be found when we sit in awe, when we simply experience moments of beauty and grace in our lives. And yet we modern 21st century human beings have a hard time, I think, finding moments of awe and wonder and opening, because in our information age, it's getting harder and harder to simply be with mystery. We have near constant access to information and opinions from all over the world. And while information and knowledge don't always go hand in hand, and I would argue are not the same thing, having information and having knowledge, we are also offered ideas and expertise from many trained professionals as well, telling us how to think and what to believe about almost anything. Journalists and economists and doctors and therapists, people telling us what is real and true, what is known, what we should accept as fact. Now, knowing, I want to say up front, is and should be valued. It's important to use our minds to think carefully and thoughtfully about many things in our lives. But I wonder sometimes if we take our appreciation for facts and information a bit too far. Do we value the ability to know so much that we have completely devalued not knowing? And what are the gifts and the benefits to having some sense of mystery in our lives? So I want to explore that with you a little bit this morning. Make a little more room up here on the pulpit. Now, our Unitarian Universalist tradition is full of preachers and lay people who throughout our history have taken deep pride in being part of a well-reasoned, thoughtful faith tradition. To this day, I know that many of you say that one of your primary motivators for being a Unitarian is that it respects your mind, that it asks you not to check your intellect at the door, at the entrance to the sanctuary, but rather to bring your thoughtfulness with you in discerning what it is that you believe. In fact, I remember when we were in the search process, almost every single congregation said that what they most wanted in sermons on Sunday mornings was intellectual stimulation. Now, I think that's all well and good, and I think that faith in our tradition has never been a blind faith. It has always been well thought out and much considered. In fact, I have often joked with my congregation that there is one of my favorite Unitarian Universalist jokes, which is that Unitarian Universalists believe in salvation by bibliography. Like all good jokes, there is some truth in it. If I came to any of your homes, I'm sure that I would find many, many, many bookshelves filled with tomes of knowledge and understanding on a dizzying array of topics. And only begrudgingly might you show me that you do have a few novels thrown in, maybe even a trashy mystery that you read during the summer. But mostly, you would be proud to show me all of the well-learned texts that you have in your home. It points to the truth of the fact that we Unitarians have seldom been liable to believe in something without proof. And we have a strong reliance on well-researched conclusions. This hallmark of our tradition is strong and vital and valuable. But it is also not without its shortcomings, and not the only wisdom that I want to argue that our forebears in this tradition have left us. Yes, they left us a tradition of thoughtful, knowledgeable faith, but they also left us some faith as well. I believe that as with most of life's critical endeavors, balance is needed. A life centered on the mind alone is not sufficient. The more we can involve our bodies and our spirits in the conversation with the head, the better off we are. One of our most well-known forebears, Ralph Waldo Emerson, understood this quite clearly and quite well. He understood that we need to allow the mystery to flourish sometimes. He understood that we need to believe and experience our lives, not simply think through our lives. He believed that Unitarianism had much to offer during his time as a minister, but he also believed that it could not do as much as it might be able to unless it was more rooted in everyday living. Those of you who know anything about Emerson know that he was a Unitarian minister, but he actually left the ordained ministry at one point in time because he was simply tired of arguing with the status quo of Unitarianism as a very cerebral tradition. In fact, Emerson was a third-generation Unitarian minister, and yet he found, as he described, a corpse-cold rationalism that was not getting where he thought we needed to go. And so he and Thoreau and all those you've heard of who created the transcendentalist movement in our faith tradition said, we need to have a faith which is not simply from the neck up, but also is engaged with life and engaged with the experiences of our existence that move us and change us. And so I want to share with you some of Emerson's words. When we go through seminary, this address of Emerson's is oft quoted to us. Emerson delivered a divinity school address at Harvard University in 1838, and he spoke to the seminary's graduating class that year about what he thought the role of preachers, the role and job and task of ministers was. And he came to this critical moment in his sermon to those students about to leave to preach the gospel, if you will. He said this, I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say I would go to church no more. A snowstorm was falling around us, and the snowstorm was real, but the preacher was merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him. And then out the window behind him, into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had not one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived or acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. This man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books, he had eaten and drunken, his head aches, his heart throbs, he smiles and suffers, yet there was not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all. The true preacher can be known by this, that he deals out to the people his life passed through the fire of thought. End quote. Now, sexism aside, since there are now more preachers in our tradition who are women than men, I side strongly with Emerson in this quotation. How important it is to bring to anything our living, to pass through the fire of our thinking, our life's experiences. What Emerson says of preachers is true for us all, that we must pass our days, our questions, our fears, our tears, our joys, through the fire of thought. Emerson seems to say that our living ought to come first, that we ought to live our lives, that we ought to be engaged with our experiences, and then step back from those experiences and think about them. What do they teach me? What lessons have I learned from these things that I have done, well or poorly? What have I learned from the mistakes I have made? What have I learned from my glorious achievements? He seems to say that we need to experience and then think and then experience again. And too often I fear that we begin with the thought. We think something all the way through before we will even attempt it. And then sometimes dismiss those things that don't line up with our thinking. Oh, that couldn't have been right. It didn't happen the way I thought it would. Oh, that can't be true, because the only things that are true are the things that happen as I think they might. When I was first starting off in ministry, I was sitting at my own ordination service, and one of my mentors in ministry said, "Now, I want you to hear carefully this advice I'm going to give to you, Shauna, because you're not going to believe what I'm about to say, but I believe with every fiber of my being that it's true." And I could feel all of us, not just me, but everyone in the congregation kind of leaning in as he said to us, "Anything worth doing in life is worth doing badly." And we looked at him like this. And then he said, "Really and truly, we live in a culture now that tells you you shouldn't even try anything unless you can be assured that you will succeed before you even start." How sad that is, he said, for how much can be learned by trying that something that you have no idea
if you'll be any good at it at all. And I think that's what Emerson is saying to us as well. We need to experience our lives and then be thoughtful about what we have experienced and go back and forth in that interaction of thought and experience, thought and experience. Latin American liberation theologians have a word for that. They call it praxis, which is a balance of action and thought and reflection, and then action again. So you do action and thought and action and thought again and again, refining and molding and shaping who you are, what you do, what you're about, how you make justice in the world, how loving you can be, over and over again, like with a piece of modeling clay. And you do that more than just with your mind. My friends, I think we need mystery. I think we need to stand in amazement and in awe, to revel in rather than fear what we don't know. There is so much that we understand about the world, about life. And yet, for all of our knowledge, for all of our understanding about so many things, there's still so much we don't understand. You can tell me and explain to me until you are blue in the face how it is that mountains are made. You can talk to me about tectonic plates, about the formation of the earth, and you still cannot explain away my awe and my wonder, the smile that comes over my face when I wake up on a morning such as this one and look at these mountains. You cannot explain away a mountain. Annie Dillard, the nature writer, once said, "We are here to give voice to our astonishments." There is so much beauty and so much appreciation for the gift of life that we find when we simply take it in, when we soak it up, when we savor it like a good meal, and say thank you. Leslie told you that my partner and I have a 6-month-old son. I was showing some people earlier before the service a video that I took of him recently because, as with all parents, I can't stop talking about him. So even though I'm only away from him for 24 hours, I can't let it go. This little guy, Demetrius is his name, had to have heart surgery here at Children's Hospital here in Vancouver, so I feel like this is a bit of a second home because a huge moment in my life was spent this summer living here for a month with him. And they explained to us the workings of his heart. They told us why he needed this surgery. They drew us diagrams of blood vessels and ventricles and arteries. And they told us what they would need to do to correct his heart, to make it a regular heart, so that he could survive. They can tell me all of this about his being, and yet they can't explain away, can't rightfully explain how it is that he's still alive, how he survived an open heart procedure at 6 days old, to be this 6.5-month-old being. I know what happened to him. But more importantly, I know what happened to him. Think about those moments in your life that you know. Think about those moments in your life that you know, that you understand, not just from any one of those books on your shelves that are filled to overflowing, but that you know because you have felt it and lived it embraced it and held it. The folk singer Iris DeBent, maybe some of you know her music, has a song entitled "Let the Mystery Be." She goes through in the song the litany of beliefs about life after death and what happens to us and why we're here in the first place. And she comes around again and again to a chorus that says this. She says, "But no one knows for certain, and it's all the same to me. So I think I'll just let the mystery be." And sometimes I think that's the best approach, because no one knows for certain about some things in our lives, and it really is kind of all the same to me. No one has the right answer or the corner on the market of truth, and so sometimes I need to let the mystery be. Karen Armstrong, perhaps you've heard of her. She delivered the Ware Lecture at General Assembly several years ago, and she talks a lot about the importance of mystery in the midst of her Charter for Compassion. Perhaps you've heard about her Charter for Compassion, which is aimed at building understanding and appreciation across all forms of difference, but especially religious differences. And she said something interesting during her Ware Lecture about the limits of knowledge. She even quoted no lesser source than Socrates. She said that Socrates understood the value of appreciating the limits of one's knowledge. She said that Socrates held that the moment that you realize that you love wisdom and recognize in that same moment that you don't yet have it is the moment when you become a philosopher. And philosophy means to study general and fundamental problems of existence and values and knowledge. So it's that moment, that kind of liminal moment, that moment on the line of, I love knowledge and I want to know more, and I don't have it. I don't get it. That's when you become a philosopher, said Socrates. And I want to say to you this morning, it's that moment when you realize that you love life, or you want to a little bit more, or you want to fall in love with life again because you used to love life and you've kind of lost it. Or you love life and, as one of the readings in our hymnal says, you want it to return your affection a little bit more. So you want to love life, and you recognize that you don't as much as you'd like to. That's the moment, that's the place where you become not so much a philosopher, or maybe you become a philosopher, but you become a liver of life. You become a lover of life. You become a person who wants to love life, not like it's a math problem to be figured out, but you want to become a human being whose prime practice and move through life is a movement of awe, a movement of gratitude, a movement of awareness, a movement of attention, movement of engagement. So that's the philosophy. I love life, but I want to love it more. I think life has a lot to teach me, but I'm not really listening. That's where the rub is of where we still have to grow. And at the end of her lecture, Karen Armstrong said, "Every single person is a sublime and sacred mystery." I think every moment of life is a sublime and sacred mystery. A sublime and sacred mystery to be embraced, not feared, not put under a microscope, to not dissected, but to be embraced. In the reading, excuse me, in the reading, in the reading that Leslie shared with you at the beginning of the service, Scott Russell Sanders describes the beauty of the mystery so well. A thunderstorm, which we don't have very many of here. The birth of a child. The moments of opening. It's my prayer for us this morning that we may seek not to contain them, or to have them answer to our reason or our demands for explanation, but rather that we might instead, with humility, be grateful for the moments of clarity that can come. May we see the mysteries of life as but beautiful illustrations of what makes life such an amazing gift. May we not only let the mystery be, but let us at times find the openness to revel in it. So may it be. And amen.